Dearest Gladys and precious bodies, welcome to the last of our week of Lunal Repeats on RN. We're about to travel to Japan in the company of author Roger Pulvers. He went to that country as a young bloke in search of himself. He fell in love with it, the culture, the literature, the whole way of being. Sit back now and wallow in Roger's joy in this intriguing country. I think tonight's Late Night Live can be described as a special edition. The focus is on Japan. My guest, Roger Pulvers, has been a friend of the programs and of mine for a very, very long time. He's an acclaimed author, journalist, playwright, theatre director, translator. He's an American-born Australian, but he spent half a century in Japan. He's published over 40 books in Japanese and English. He's received all sorts of awards in Japan for the translation of Japanese literature. Now, his new memoir, and let me hold it up because it's just fresh. It's still hot from the printing press, and we're taping this, Roger, so this is not my usual silly nonsense of holding up a book or a microphone and a radio program. We are actually being rendered televisual. Japan, If There Were No Japan, a cultural memoir by Roger Pulvers. It's been hailed in Japan as an essential roadmap for the future, and after 2 decades of economic stagnation and perhaps cultural malaise, topped off by the devastation of the tsunami and Fukushima, both of which Roger has discussed on the program, this sounds exactly what Japan needs. However, Japan's younger generation is pessimistic. They don't want to be like their parents who burnt themselves out rebuilding Japan after the war, dedicating body and soul to work with little left to spare. And there are few role models for this generation to follow. But Roger, as it will emerge, is optimistic about the future. He first-hand observed Japan's cultural rejuvenation during the 60s and the 80s and argues that the Japanese people have within them all the tools to create a new era, one vastly different to the past. Roger, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's good to talk to you. I was going to joke about the fact that you've attained sumo stature or that you're a sort of a very tall, thin Australian-American samurai. But the thing that fascinates me about you is that while you are celebrated in Japan, while your contribution is recognised, I've always found Japan the most enigmatic of cultures. I find it almost excruciatingly intense in its cultural expressions. I have never felt more alien in my life
really?
Than on my various visits to Japan, feelings that I hardly ever get anywhere else. And I wonder this. You are acknowledged and celebrated, but are you really accepted by the Japanese, or are you an anomaly to them?
Well, from the very first day that I arrived in Japan in September 1967, a very hot summer's day, late in the afternoon from Los Angeles, there was no Narita airport, it was Haneda International Airport. And I didn't speak a word of Japanese, and I didn't know any Japanese people. Someone said later, a couple of days later, you should go to Osaka. I'd never heard of Osaka. This was before, you know, Japan became like a cool thing to know, and you know, in the West. And I got into a taxi from the airport and went to a hotel in Meguro, which is a suburb of Tokyo. And through the window of that taxi, at dusk, at twilight, I looked through the window. It was like looking through a magic lantern. And I said to myself, after being in the country for 45 minutes, and I kid you not, I remember saying this, of course in English, I didn't speak Japanese, I'm going to stay in this country for the rest of my life. I felt immediately at home.
But do they feel at home with you?
Well, that's for other people to decide. What does belonging mean? I mean, the important thing for me, and I think for everybody, is what you think of yourself. It's other people don't define you. They don't say what you are. You're the person who says what you are. And what is acceptance? I mean, I have the most wonderful friends, the most deep friendships with many Japanese people.
But you understand why I'm asking you this.
Yes, I do. I don't think it's relevant. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say yes or no because that's something for somebody else to answer. I mean, am I accepted as an Australian? I gave up my American citizenship on July 6th, 1976, 2 days after the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence of the United States. I don't have dual citizenship. I became an Australian. And yet in the 1970s, when I was here, Australians didn't accept me as an Australian. And, you know, I would say, hello, how are you? And they'd say, oh, you haven't lost a twang, have you, mate? You know, and I wanted to be an Australian playwright and an Australian author. And obviously, there was a sort of cultural renaissance going on, a nationalistic kind of movement at the time in theater and film,
and
which was a good thing.
Mixed, very conflicted views about the United States.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I didn't have conflicted views about the United States. I didn't like the place at all. I didn't want to be an American anymore. I used to go down to Melbourne a lot because I had plays on at La Mama and I knew the people at the Pram Factory and I identified with the kind of theater that was being done down there. And the people in Carlton, now this is a bit off the Japanese subject, but I'll get back to it. You know, the intellectuals and the cultural people, they fancied themselves as very anti-American. And yet they were all watching American television shows and they loved the place. And a couple of years later, many of them went to the U.S. and they came back and they said, oh, America's fantastic. You know, they very conflicted because there's no difference now to what's going on in Australia, in the Australian psyche vis-a-vis America. You often call it a love-hate relationship, but it's to me, it's something very, very different. It's a kind of dependence that Australians have on American values and American approval. I didn't have that. I gave that up completely. And so I didn't have any feelings about being accepted here or in Japan. I was on a journey to find myself, to make a life for myself in the arts.
Well, you've certainly done that.
Well, but I don't know if I have, but that was my journey.
Even your physicality, your perpendicularity, you would have stopped the traffic in Japan. I remember my first wife, who was quite a tall woman, she drew crowds because she was, in fact, unusually tall.
Philip, they're a lot taller than they used to be. I go on the train, there are Japanese young women who are taller than me and a lot of young men who are taller than me. Anyway, to go back to your question, for me, it's not an issue at all. Not at all. And I mean, not at all. Even my father said, and I've quoted this in the book, he said, you know, what do you want to stay in Japan for? You'll never be accepted. Even my father, who knew nothing about life outside of the United States at all, was telling me that I wasn't going to be accepted. And the answer is, I feel on my own home ground in Japan.
Now, clearly, your books are very accepted in Japan. This book was a bestseller. And as I said, it's described as a roadmap for Japan's future. You must be pleased. What are the Japanese looking for right now?
The Japanese are at sea. For the last 20 years or 20-odd years, the Japanese have found that the old model that was working for them before, you know, keep your nose to the grindstone and the men will stay in the office late and the women will look after the family and the home. I'm not saying this is a good thing, but this was basically the deal that was made, between men and women in post-war Japan. And generally men who worked for bigger companies gave their loyalty to the company, and if they were sent overseas, they generally went alone. Not always, but often they went alone. And everything seemed to be going very, very well until the so-called asset bubble burst around probably in late 1990 or 1991. And even then, my Japanese friends were saying, this is a good thing. It's an adjustment, a technical adjustment. 5 years, we're going to hunker down and we're going to come back again. And I remember saying to them, no, it's not going to happen. This is something different. But Philip, if I may talk for a minute about Japanese history, because it's very, very relevant to this point. The Meiji period from 1868 to 1912 is the time that Japan came out of 250 years of national isolationism and built in 30 years, accomplished in 30 years what it took Europe 250 years to accomplish and what it took America over 100 years to accomplish, that is becoming a modern nation state with a powerful army and a small empire. Whether that's good or bad, again, of course it wasn't, turned out to be very, very bad, but they were playing the same game that Westerners were playing. But if the Meiji Restoration started in 1868 and, say, 22 years later, 1890, we were sitting in Japan, we would have said Japan is lost. People don't know what they're doing. All of the young people were didn't know what they wanted out of life, and the old people thought they should go back to the old customs that were tried and true, tried for and were honored for hundreds of years. And yet, out of that came a new model for growth and national independence and stature on the international stage. So 20 years or 20 odd years being at sea and being lost is nothing in terms of, it's not even one generation. And I think Japan is poised once again to make a comeback on the terms of a different kind of model. I'm an optimist.
That long period of isolation, of self-willed isolation, yes, led to that intensification of cultures, which I described as excruciating at the beginning. It is stunningly beautiful in all its manifestations, but it has that intensity. These days, one would observe that to some extent, in fact to a large extent, that sort of intensity is being replaced by cultural hybridization.
Well, I think it was not altogether a bad thing that Japan isolated itself at a time when European powers were wreaking havoc all around Asia and the Pacific. And in fact, the Japanese were not occupied by a foreign power. They weren't Christianized, and they retained their cultural and national identity. So at a cost...
It's not a criticism, cost, it's an observation. Cost,
yeah, but what's happening now is completely different. Japan is, I'm sorry to say this, and we can talk about it in specifically, it's a much more international place than Australia is, I'm sorry to say. I mean, it's really clued in and tuned into the cultures of various European countries and in theater, in music, in film, and of course very close to the United States, even closer than Australia is. And Japan still remains the only country in the world that implicitly and very profoundly understands both the United States and China.
Following the Second World War.
And I think that's an important point.
Following World War II, which of course ended catastrophically for Japan, you described the country as having been left in a moral void created by two generations of leaders who had betrayed the humanistic values of Japanese culture. You've been on the program quite recently, seeing new forms of betrayal.
Yeah, well, if you want to talk about what's happening now in Japan, absolutely. I wouldn't go as far as to say it's equivalent to the betrayal of the Japanese people in the 1930s and the first 5 years of the 1940s. But it's certainly a culture of cover-up and disinformation that's going on in Japan. It's the last dying kicks of the old generation trying to assert itself and keep power and keep the hands on the purse strings of the nation at a time when there are profound changes going on in Japan and elsewhere in Asia. So I don't for a minute think that Japan is on a militaristic thrust into Asia or the South Pacific as it was in the 1930s or 40s. I don't think that's a danger. I'm sorry to say, there may be people in China who claim that, but I really don't think the signs are there for that. However, there is a culture of cover-up and a culture of disinformation that goes on in Japan, which is muddling the situation and making it much harder for people in Japan to create a new model of growth and development.
Now, the world's leaders, irrespective of country, are driven almost totally by economics, and you note that a nation's creativity does not flow from the economy as such.
No, I've always said it's the exact opposite. It's the economy that rides on the back of the culture. And I think the Chinese have realized this, and one country which uses the popular culture better than any other country, I think, is the United States of America. I mean, in disseminating their culture and their power through marketing and very clever propaganda.
But one would observe that, well, as you know, I spent most of my life fighting against that sort of cultural domination of the United States here. But the same sort of osmosis is now well advanced, as you say, in Japan.
Yeah, the Japanese in the 1950s, the generation that was still in school during the war and didn't go to war, people who were born, say, after 1930, around that time, those were the people who were betrayed, and those were the young people who embraced American democracy and American values and baseball and American cinema and the jargon of American popular culture. But what's important is that when I arrived in Japan in 1967, what I saw is massive demonstrations, not only by radical students. If people think that was a radical student movement that was out there on the streets of Shinjuku and other parts of Tokyo, and by all means, and Kyoto as well, and other cities as well. It wasn't only students. There were ordinary working people there. There were men, older people, women. This was a mass protest movement against the direction that Japan was taking.
And it was a cry, a mass cry for rejuvenation, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but it had an immense effect on the culture, on the film culture, on the theater culture. Japan in the 1960s was really in the avant-garde of world culture, and I saw that. So that has remained with me, and I think I talk a lot about that in the book, because maybe not so many people were around then and saw the plays and had contact with the actors and the directors that I was fortunate enough to have. And so I saw that, and I realized that what's the apathy that we see in Japan today and the retrogression in thought and in particularly political action is actually an anomaly. I think the Japanese people, they appear calm. You ask them their opinion. Opinion polls don't always work in Japan, because people might tell you what they think you want to hear and what they think you want to hear. And then all of a sudden, there's a turning over and they go in another direction entirely, and the old guard is thrown out. And I think we're if not on the brink of that, I think we're heading toward a major sea change in Japanese culture and in Japanese political thought.
Let's look at another aspect of Japanese culture briefly, and that's religion, or the lack thereof. You point out that Japan escaped the Christian missionaries. But my observations, my astonishment when I first visited the country, was that to a large extent it's an agnostic society. You know, it professes Buddhism, Shinto, but it's not deeply felt. It's rather like going to church on the odd Sunday in our culture.
That's right.
It's a country, therefore, that isn't driven by a traditional concept of faith.
Not faith, not in the West, certainly in the Western sense. I think there's a certain kind of spirituality in Japan, and that the people feel very, very strongly. But going back to that first day in Japan and those first weeks, I had been so fed up, Philip, with the rhetoric of American religiosity that was merely a shield for the most awful kind of hypocrisy and violence, particularly the Vietnam War, because that's why I left America, finally, because I was against the Vietnam War. But not only that, and we see it still today, so it's not as if anything has changed. And even with Obama, you know, the God bless this and the God bless that. And I mean, when I went to Japan, it wasn't there. And if you ask a Japanese person, what is your religion? Almost all of them will say Mushukyo, which means I have no religion. And I said to my students,
they are.
Well, I said in the book, and I believe this strongly, that Japan is the world's greatest secular democracy. And this is another thing. Not only do the Japanese generally, of course, there are Christians, about 1% of the population is Christian, and there are Muslims and there are other people of other religions. So it's not as if everybody's like that, but the vast majority is like that. And they have very, very deep respect for all religions in the world. Honestly, for Islam, for Christianity, for Judaism, they always ask questions and they want to know about other people's religion. And therefore, they can play a very significant role in any kind of what's referred to euphemistically as the clash of civilization, any kind of clash of civilization that the West and other countries can muster. And I think the Japanese actually are very good at diplomacy and at bringing people together, at not having grudges and gripes and not having really strong feelings of orthodoxy. Mind you, from 1930 to 1945, that wasn't the case at all, and they went berserk. And the Japan that most people still remember, subconsciously perhaps, particularly older people in Europe, in Australia, in the United States, and in China as well, in Korea, is the old Japan. They think of the Japanese as fanatic, as dogmatic, and I don't see them that way.
But every part of the world went through that same frenzy. Look at what happened in Europe.
Of course.
It's not just the Japanese who discovered their inner fanatic. I remember when I'd go to China at the time of the Iron Rice Bowl, when people had a sense of security, funnily enough, that had been provided by the communists. There was in Japan, the Japan that I first visited, a sort of a parallel, which was the expectation of lifetime employment within a corporation.
Yes.
In fact, when a Japanese person introduced themselves, they just as often preface the introduction by identifying their corporation. Now, as the world has sort of fallen apart in this sense, has this led to, or did it lead to, a great insecurity within the Japanese?
Yes, it has, a disorientation. And the young people generally cannot look forward to lifetime employment. Most of them can't. And in fact, since Prime Minister Abe has taken power, the number of permanent employees of companies has gone down by 1.1 million. The number of workers has gone up, and he always says in recent months in particular, say we now have more people working than we did before, and that's true. But 40% of the Japanese workforce is what's called non-regular workers. That means casual workers or part-time workers without the same sorts of security that workers have, you know, and if they get sick and so on. So, and the wages are much, much lower depending on, obviously, the industry that they're in. So there is an insecurity, but one should look at these things in a positive light. It's the failure of my generation, our generation, that did not prepare the groundwork for young people to run at their own pace and in their own direction. That had happened before in Japan, and that's why Japan was so successful with people like Mr. Matsushita from Panasonic, Honda, Mr. Honda from Honda, Mr. Morita from Sony. Not only that, hundreds of incredibly clever, creative, well-rounded business people who cared about the products that they made and sold them all around the world. We now the older people say, oh, the young people of Japan are not like that. They don't have the fight, or the hustle, or they're not hungry. These are three words which were used in the 50s and 60s and 70s, which have gone out of the language. And older people constantly say that young people don't have these things, and they're lethargic and they lack energy and so on. But it's the fault of the older generation for not preparing the kind of society in which young people will be creative, innovative, and successful. And unfortunately, that's one of the big problems in Japan, because the older generation is still holding on, and they have to let go.
Ellen Ill on RN, and my guest is the old friend of the program, Roger Pulvers, and his new book is called If There Were No Japan. One of the reasons you've been so successful in Japan is that I know you to be someone of insatiable curiosity, and you spent a lot of time in traditional theatre, even studying the art of groaning. Now, this is a part of the cultural intensification process that I was talking about at the outset. Groaning. You sought out a teacher to teach you groaning.
Well, wait a second. No, well, it's not exactly groaning. Now, there's an old art form of one person singing a ballad, a kind of ballad, and doing all the parts of a play, and it takes... One performance takes 30 minutes. This was very, very popular up until the wartime. It actually is not a traditional art of Japan. It's called Naniwabushi, and it started up in the early Meiji period. So it's only about 150 years old or so. And I took an interest in this, the only foreigner who ever did, and I went to see one of the great old masters. Tsukuba Musashi was his name, and I said, I want to be your apprentice, and I want to learn how to sing Naniwabushi. And he said, you don't sing Naniwabushi, you unaru, you groan Naniwabushi. And so I learned how to groan out this ballad and do all the parts of a play. And I went around with him to old people's homes, because by then, we're talking 1970, 1971, the young people of Japan had no interest whatsoever in Naniwabushi, in this particular art, and the old people were very pleased that a foreigner had come and taken up this art form.
I'm astonished that you didn't become a very thin sumo wrestler, but you but you did get your hands on every single piece of major Japanese literature and every classic.
Yeah, I devoured Japanese culture. From the very beginning, Philip, I fell in love with Japan. And I'm not talking about the exotic Japan. Isn't it wonderful? There's such quaint, unusual people and so artistic. Not at all. I went for the grotty. I went for the black humor. In fact, in the first few years, I didn't want to have anything to do with the classical tradition. It bored me. I wanted to learn what was the essence of Japanese theatricality. Theatricality on stage, theatricality in the culture, theatricality in business, theatricality in personal relationships. And I wanted to get to the bottom of this amazing culture, this culture that still has forms of it alive and being creative at a very high level for hundreds of years, sometimes 1,000 years, contemporary with the most avant-garde, amazing design of architecture, food. The world has finally discovered Japanese food. And as I say in the book, I have a little chapter called The Design of Time, because the Japanese, through all of their art, design time. A Japanese meal, for instance, is put in front of you. It dictates how you approach it, how you look at it. Maybe you take the lid off and you get a smell, a fragrance that you hadn't had. You see some beautiful presentation. That takes time. It's telling you, slow down. Let's take this in. Let's think. Let's absorb. And then you taste it, and then another dish comes. And it's a different color and a different design, and it's very small. And one of the great things about Japanese food culture is that they eat less than we do. There's a Japanese phrase called hara hachibu, which means you should only eat until your stomach is 80% full, and never, which means don't overeat. And so before you get full, you should stop eating. And this, even the way people talk to each other, the way they relate to each other, it appealed to me. It wasn't that I was losing myself in some foreign culture, because I was steeped in the American Jewish culture. You know, we've talked about that before. I love the Jewish jokes. I can tell them for hours on end. In last November, I put out a book about the impact of Jewish culture on American life, mostly about film and comedy in Japan. The book came out in Japan. But and I went to the Soviet Union in 1964, when Khrushchev was still in power. As you know, I studied Russian, and that was my major. And then I went to Poland. And I loved those cultures too. So it wasn't that I lost myself in Japan, and it wasn't exclusive to anything else. We have a lot of identities, and to me, it was just one of them. And Australia, which became my country. I mean, I don't sound like a lot of Aussies, but I am an Australian. But I mean, But Japan offered something that no other culture did, and that was
I understand this impulse yeah. clearly. I've been collecting Edo screens and Japanese pottery, which I think is sublime, among other things. And one of the things, the art forms I most loved was and remains the woodcuts. Mm. And that, to me, raises another area which no one ever talks about, and that's Japanese sexuality.
Mm.
Let's talk about that briefly, because the eroticism in Japanese art is absolutely open, full on. It's not pornographic. It's beyond
some of
that.
It is very pornographic.
I don't know. I just think
the shunga. Yes, there was just an exhibit last year in Britain of Japanese shunga. I think it.
But
I
think
of
that pornography involves a reaction to guilt. And in that sense, it's not pornographic.
Right.
It's so open in that regard.
Yeah.
Japanese sexuality.
Japanese have a sense of shame about the body and about sex, as we all do in all of our cultures, but not sin. That was given to us by my born culture, the Jewish culture, and by the Christians, and by some other religions, which I won't mention right here. But they don't have that. And so I do go into the design of sexuality a little bit in If There Were No Japan, in talking about the ukiyo-e, the woodblock prints that you mentioned, but also about a marvelous artist who's almost unknown in Japan today, a 19th century Shikoku artist. Shikoku is one of the islands, the main islands near Kyushu in Japan. And his name was Ekin, and E-K-I-N, and he used to go around from village to village and paint huge screens for use in matsuri festivals. And those pictures, I ask the listeners, if they're interested, to look up E-K-I-N and put in the name in Japan, and I'm sure it will come up. Some of them are very violent and grotesque, and some of them they're very in your face. They're very blatant. But all of the Japanese ukiyo-e woodblock artists, all of them, I shouldn't say all of them, almost all of them also carved shunga, and shunga is literal translation is spring pictures. It's a euphemism. It means erotic pictures. And they're amazing. I mean, they're beautiful. And the men and the women are enjoying what's going on. And they're totally unabashed and unashamed. But because the Japanese... I mean, as far as I know, there are no nude beaches in Japan, and most Asian people are not as open about nudity as we are, you know, openly
what
in public as Europeans.
What about homosexuality? What's the attitude?
The homosexual tradition is very, goes back a long way in Japan. In fact, Saikaku, one of the great writers of the Edo period, which was from the 17th century to the 19th century, wrote a marvelous book about, called The Loves in English. It's called The Loves of the Samurai, and it's about samurai having it off with each other and so on. And there are novels about lesbian love. Tanizaki Junichiro, the famous 20th century author, wrote a wonderful novel called Manji, which has been made twice into a film, which is about lesbianism. But generally speaking, one thing you can say about all of Japanese, let's say, nonconformism or, I want to be very careful what I say, not doing what most other people do, is that as long as you do it in private and don't make a scene, then there will be no problem. But if you
don't do it in the street and frighten the policeman.
Well, no, if you... The whole feeling in Japan about rights is very different in the West, you know, because we come from a Hellenic tradition and of the individual and so on. And that basically doesn't exist in the same form in Japan. So homosexuals have lived and can live very happily together, and everybody knows. And there are there are a lot of gay performers openly and so on. No problem whatsoever. But just a couple of days ago, Shibuya Ward in Tokyo, one of the major districts of Tokyo, said that they will allow gay marriage. I think it's like 2 days ago. So it's coming in Japan in the Western sense. But the freedom for these people has always existed, and there hasn't been the kind of blatant discrimination, which, as there has been in the West, which, after all, comes from our religiosity, doesn't it, Philip? I mean,
yes,
to a large extent.
One of the things I like is the effect of time on human creation. I rather like the fact that Venice is slowly sinking into the lagoon. It's appropriate. The pyramids should crumble. It's a part of its time as an artist. Now, that's a part of the Japanese attitude to art, isn't it?
Well, the opening lines of the Heike Monogatari or Shogyo Mujo, all is vanity and evanescence, and everything changes. In the West, we say a thing of beauty is a joy forever, but in Japan, it isn't. It's a joy for a short time. And the cherry blossom is beautiful, but it's a symbol of Japan because it only lasts for a few days and then it's gone. And there's in the traditional Japanese house, there's a little wooden veranda on the ground floor that comes right out of the sliding doors before you get into the garden. And that's often called a nureng. And nureng means a moist or wet veranda because it's hit by the rain and it decays. And in the decaying process, you see beauty. You don't see beauty in the eternal, the symmetrical, and the solid. You see it in that which breaks down. That is one of the fundamental principles of Japanese aesthetics.
Now, we're talking the loftiest realms of Japanese culture.
We are.
Let's now look at the other side. The absolute crudity of so much Japanese humor. Clive James did very well at recycling bad Japanese television for years, and we all laugh at it and make mock of it. Explain that to me, that incredible...
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's the Japanese are, in the one sense, in public. They appear very dour and very straight-laced and formal. But in private, they just let their hair down and they're just like anybody else. So it doesn't surprise
me. Don't they?
Lots of very crude but not in public. But it's only in recent years that we've been doing it in public. My father was born in 1903, an uneducated man, but when he came to Australia and someone used the word toilet, he was outraged. He said, don't say that word in front of a woman. I mean, we didn't...
This is Hayes office stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, yeah, that's right. That was incorporated through the Hayes office. But I mean, we didn't do all of this swearing and talk about sex in public until relatively recently. So I don't know that the Japanese are very, very, but that different, but that vulgar aspect of Japanese culture, vulgar in both the sense of being common and being crude, has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years and is very much a part of the mainstream culture.
You've also been very much involved in the Japanese film industry. Now, we have a debt to Japan, which I don't think people quite recognise. Whenever I see a new complex, sophisticated television series these days coming out of Denmark or France or even the United States, one is aware that we no longer tell stories simply from one viewpoint. We move them around. We look at them from various angles. Various protagonists are allowed to have their say. That seems to me to be invented in Japan. And I think of Rashomon as one of the all-time masterpieces it did just that.
Well, that's right. The Kurosawa's film did do that, but it's by no means limited to Kurosawa. If you ask a lot of European directors what their favorite film is, they'll say Tokyo Monogatari by Ozu. The grammar of Japanese film from the 1920s on was not the grammar of the Hollywood film. Obviously, there were influences. Ozu, the music in Ozu's film is very much Hollywood, and I think he was very envious of the kind of the way that Hollywood movies used background music and so on, but for effect. But the influence of Japanese culture, the Japanese film culture, particularly in Europe, is immense and is to this day. But it goes back to the discovery of Japan, of Japanese culture, in the 1860s and 70s. There's no impressionism without the Japanese. Van Gogh, Monet, they were all so enamored of and besotted with Japanese culture. They collected Japanese art. They copied. They were copyists, you know.
Japan is accused of being the nation of copyists, but the West embraced and copied Japanese
culture. The level of Japanese craft, particularly in the Meiji period, but even afterwards, of lacquerware, pottery, every kind of design, the fabric design, the color combinations. There is nowhere in the world that has achieved that sophistication and that degree of excellence that the Japanese had. And, Philip, it all goes back to what you said in the beginning of the program, they still have it. You don't lose these things. A culture doesn't lose these things. It's there for the reinvention.
The old cultures are still enduring. They will survive.
They have survived. I go around Japan a lot giving talks to schools, to businesses, I do this quite a lot, and I say particularly to the young people, Japan is ripe for reinvention. You don't have to find something, go to America or go to France to find it. You can find it right in your own home ground. There's an old Japanese phrase, todai moto kurashi, it's dark under the lighthouse. And many people always look far away and don't see what's at their feet. This can be said of Australian culture too, by the way. We're always looking out and don't realize the riches we have here. And I tell the Japanese people, you've got it all here. That doesn't mean you reject what's outside, but find it again, rediscover it, recreate it, and reinvent it, and Japan will come back.
I started the program by questioning you about the acceptance within Japan by the Japanese people. One has to observe that over a long period, there has been within Japanese society a very strong sense of racial superiority.
I don't believe that at all.
Well,
I don't agree with that.
What about the Ainu in
the
Japan?
Ainu?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Ainu were an indigenous people, largely in Hokkaido, but also in other parts of northern Japan. and they were, unfortunately, largely wiped out by the Japanese, just like we wiped out our Aborigines and Aboriginals, and the Americans committed genocide on the Native Americans. And I don't think
I think that's terrible, but
I don't think that means Americans consider themselves racially superior.
What about the Japanese attitude to Koreans?
Well, the Koreans and the Japanese are culturally quite close because the great culture that came to Japan between roughly, say, the 9th century, 8th, 9th century, until, well, the 15th century, came through Korea. It was a Buddhist culture, calligraphy, architecture, philosophy. A lot of the arts were very, very much influenced by Korea. And I think a lot of Japanese feel very beholden to the Koreans for that. There are geopolitical problems, just like, and this is going to be a hell of a tangent, just like there's a very big geopolitical problem between Jews and Muslims. But we got along for hundreds and hundreds of years with the Muslim, with Islam, and Islam did with Judaism before there was a geopolitical problem. And I think it's wrong to see these questions as racial questions. They're political. They're not racial. We didn't get along. The Jews and the Christians had problems. The Jews were persecuted by the Christians. That was serious.
Okay,
I said that just for a second. I said that because that's the same. There are geopolitical problems now between Korea. They're very minor. And with the so-called Dokto or Takeshima Islands that are between the two, and also between the interpretation of what happened during the war. But that's because the present Japanese government is being revanchist about this and chauvinist about this. If they weren't, then I think these would disappear. It's not a racial problem. That doesn't mean that all Koreans like Japanese and vice versa. They're people are, you know, have problems.
Let me come at this from a different angle, and I'll use a term from Jewish culture, marrying out. In Japan, if a Japanese boy or girl was thinking of marrying out of the Japanese culture, what would the family reaction likely be?
Now there are, some say that 1 in 10 marriages are international marriages now in Japan. I don't have the statistics, and I can't quote that. The listeners will verify that themselves. But no, obviously, most people are happier when their children marry their own kind.
I mean, the Jews were certainly that way.
My parents were up in arms about non-Jewish girls. I mean, they couldn't believe that I would ever contemplate this sort of thing. And so, does that make them racist? No, it makes them provincial, old-fashioned, and narrow-minded. But I don't think my parents were racist because when later on, they were perfectly accepting of it. And I think a lot of Japanese people are insular and provincial and narrow-minded about this particular thing. But that is really changing. Of all the things that's changing, that is one of them.
One of our last programs together involved the great poet Kenji, whom you have translated exceptionally well. You regard him as one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, don't you?
Yes, I do. One of the great poets, yeah. He was born in 1896, died in 1933 in a small town in Iwate Prefecture in the north in Tohoku called Hanamaki, very small town. Today and then as well. And he was an agronomist. He was a scientist. He was a religious thinker, and he was a poet. But he became the greatest poet of the 20th century in Japan. And so I knew his brother very well. And reading him changed my life. And I wouldn't have become a writer had I not discovered the works of Miyazawa Kenji.
I'd like you to change our lives now by reading.
Okay. All right, well, I'll read his most famous poem. In Japanese, it's called Ame ni Momakezu, Strong in the Rain, in English. strong in the rain, strong in the wind, strong against the summer heat and snow. He is healthy and robust, free from desire. He never loses his temper nor the quiet smile on his lips. He eats 4 go of unpolished rice, miso, and a few vegetables a day. He does not consider himself in whatever occurs. His understanding comes from observation and experience, and he never loses sight of things. He lives in a little thatched roof hut in a field in the shadows of a pine tree grove. If there is a sick child in the east, he goes there to nurse the child. If there's a tired mother in the west, he goes to her and carries her sheaves. If someone is near death in the south, he goes and says, "Don't be afraid." If there is strife and lawsuits in the north, he demands that the people put an end to their pettiness. He weeps at the time of drought. He plods about at a loss during the cold summer. Everybody calls him blockhead. No one sings his praises or takes him to heart. That is the kind of person I want to be.
And that is a perfect expression of what you were talking about earlier, the humanistic tradition.
That's right, the selflessness, that's right, which showed up in the response to the tsunami and earthquake of March 11th, you know, which is now, 4 years ago. The people were marvelous. They didn't think of themselves. They thought of other people. They cried for other people. They sacrificed themselves. They gave food to other people rather than even when they were hungry. And I'd like to think that that is the true nature of the Japanese people.
Roger, it's lovely to have you back on the program. As I said, you're a member of our inner sanctum, very much a part of the Late Night Live family.
Thank
Roger's
you so
book,
much.
If There Were No Japan, a cultural memoir, is published by Deep Breath, Japan Publishing Industry Foundation for Culture. The book is not immediately available. It will be available soon. And, dear listener, I promise to alert you to that and give you the information in due course. That's all for now. Stick around now for the news on RN, and we'll talk soon.